And yet, it's a little later, he shows her.
Because it's random. It's not hers, right?
Please pray.
Okay. Yes.
You know how to make this mic go live?
You know Ryan Kinahan? You ever run into him?
How is that?
He works for me.
Don't do the
remodel. I'm not calling any of the official
members. You know, it's her first time going to class, too. So.
Right, and she's brand new to the organization, so she doesn't even know anybody.
Now you would like that.
You can't.
Well, you know Bono, I got Bono Villa. Bono, she's big. But first, probably would be in.
He's already
Yeah, I agree with that.
I wonder what the
I often watch.
This is when they were saying 10.
Fascinating. One of my first times was, let me think about it. I was 20, you know, how old was I? 22. In the old days when they used to do with the lead type, you know, a type set of linotype machines. I don't even know how long it's been. No, rows of linotype machines.
Good morning. My name is Bill Jeter. I'm the lawyer for the 2023 Value Adjustment Board. This is the 2023 Value Adjustment Board Special Magistrate Orientation Session. I want to welcome everybody, and I'm looking forward to another year with many familiar faces, and we have a new face or two, and we welcome you, and this should be a good session, I think. Thank you all for coming, and I'm going to invite your participation anytime, all the time. Our microphone situation is somewhat limited, so what I'm going to do is, if I recognize someone to speak, I'm going to hand you this microphone so that you can speak and be on the record and be properly recorded. As you know, this is in the sunshine, so this entire meeting will be recorded and be on the record, but then we're just going to have to share the microphone, unless if we may be able to get some new microphones before we're done. Just quick housekeeping, if you parked at the Enterprise parking garage at the corner of Main and Duval, the city has an arrangement, and we can take your ticket and validate it, and you won't have to pay for parking. So if you have one of those tickets, if you'll turn it in, then we're going to get it. We'll get it validated for you. You should have picked up, when you went through the line, packets which one of which is entitled Special Magistrate Orientation. Your proposed special magistrate contract, which you may fill out and sign and turn in today if you would like. It is the same as last year's contract, if that's useful information to you, other than the board voted to increase your hourly rate to $125. So that change is in this contract. The increase is shown there. If you prefer to take the contract back to your office and fill it out and look it over, whatever you want to do, that's fine. But we need to have the original blue-pink hard copy back. We can't accept a scan of that because the contract has still to be signed by the board chair, the board clerk, and by me. And if we scan it, we lose the, you know, what we need to have for that. So you can scan and send it an FYI, but you're going to have to mail us or bring us the hard copy. So if you want to do it, if you are comfortable signing it today, we'll take them and be glad to have them. And then when we get the other signatures, we'll send you an executed, fully conformed executed copy. Also included among the materials you should have picked up is I photocopied Module 6 from the 2023 VAB training. This is valuation special magistrate specific, although it of course contains many of the same terms and provisions that apply to TPP and attorney standards. But I'm going to spend a little time talking about it, and I thought that the valuation special magistrates might like to have a hard copy of this, since we're required to computer take the training. If you don't have a hard copy, if you're like me, I benefit from having a hard copy, and I hope that you will too. I'm going to go through it some as we go through the meeting today. Finally, we have provided you a copy of the DOR's Uniform Policies and Procedures Manual for Value Adjustment Boards. This is the most recent update from September of 2022, and it is probably going to be supplanted soon, I hope, by an update, and then that'll be made available to you on our website, on the DOR websites, and if somebody wants me to make a copy, a hard copy for them, I will. Our format today is I'm going to try to finish everything up by noon. We will take 10-minute breaks at the top of each hour. If I get wound up and forget to take the break, somebody alert me and I'll do that. And this is pretty informal. If you need to go out and make a call or do something, certainly don't worry about it. Just kind of come and go as you please. But we'll have official breaks for 10 minutes at the top of each hour. I'm going to first spend some time on the special magistrate orientation materials that I provided you and just sort of go through that for overview purposes. This year's VAB, as you know, the VAB consists of two council members, a school board member and a citizen member appointed by council who must own homestead property in the county, and a citizen member appointed by the school board who must own a business that operates within the school district. Our board this year is council member Will Lehman, council member Maman Johnson. The alternate council member is council member Joe Carlucci. The school board member is Ms. Lori Hershey. The two citizen members are carryovers. Those are all new, by the way, from the board. They did not serve in the past. Our citizen members, however, are welcome, and we have some pickup materials if you'd like to grab some. Our citizen members are veterans. They are Shirley Dasher, who's appointed by the council, and Dominique Cummings, who's appointed by the school board. And so they are back. It is my pleasure to introduce you to your staff, who needs no introduction. The official clerk of the Value Adjustment Board, who is not here, is by statute the clerk to the governing body of the county. And so that would be Margaret or Peggy Sidman, who's the city council secretary and who serves as the, by statute, as the clerk to the Value Adjustment Board. Her chief of legislative services is Marianne Lemure, and Marianne's involved in the Value Adjustment Board, but not officially part of the VAB staff, but she's active and very very helpful to its activities. The assistant chief of legislative services in charge of VAB is Heather Pelican, and she is assisted by legislative assistant Jonathan Griffith. And Jonathan Griffiths is, well, this is your third year, and he knows everything now. He's a quick study, and we're glad to have Jonathan with us, and Heather just is, Heather and he are incredibly hardworking. I'm going to tell you about all the petitions that we have this year. There's a lot of them. They've been coming in at 6:30 and staying after hours trying to get everything logged in so that you can be kept busy going forward. Heather, are you sure you have no announcements or anything? Okay, good. I always mention the document that you are not receiving. That's your W-9. And all of you, I assume, if you haven't already, will coordinate with VAB staff to make sure that you are paid by automatic draft to your checking account, and that your W-9, which shows the same tax ID number and name to which you want your payments made, is known to the VAB staff. If you make a change, please keep us posted. They don't issue checks anymore. They want to pay you directly, and it's much more efficient anyway. Okay, we'll go through, and by the way, if anybody wants to interrupt me with questions at any time, just raise your hand, because I'm happy to stop. I'm just going to go in order through the special magistrate orientation materials just to tell you generally what's here and why it's here. And page 2 is a list of special magistrates and what your assigned category is. And the DOR was late, as we know, with its VAB training. And so we all have to kind of hustle to get that completed. Once you have completed your VAB training, please send by email a scanned copy of your certificate of completion to VAB staff. And you also need to send a copy of the certificate to the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue will add you to its list. You can see the most recent list that I was able to find, at least as of September 14th. They may have come out with a new one this week. But this is a list which includes some of us of those special magistrates who have completed their training and provided the DOR with proof of that. And we need that. Not only do we need your certificate, before you can be scheduled for a hearing, I need to make sure the DOR acknowledges your training and that you filed your certificate with them. So please don't forget that. If you have any difficulty with that, let me know and I'll try to assist. Page 4, the Value Adjustment Board invoice has not changed from last year. We ask that you submit, except you'll notice the rate on this one's at 110. And it'll be 125, this year, as I told you, per contract. The staff asks that you submit an invoice every 2 weeks. You will be paid for this meeting, and they would like you to invoice for this meeting promptly. That way, staff can kind of keep you paid on a regular basis and also be aware of what you are doing. Please enter a narrative description of what you have done and how much time it took you to do it, and then do the math to determine the amount that you are owed. You are, of course, paid for all time spent at VAB hearings. When you're in the VAB room, we do ask you to use your downtime between hearings to work on your special magistrate recommendations so that we get productive use of your time. But you're paid the entire time that you are at the hearing, and then you're allowed allotted times of 3 hours after the hearing to complete a residential recommended decision, and 4 hours after the hearing, allotted time to complete a TPP or a commercial recommended decision. Now, that is not a one-size-fits-all. You are going to have instances where either the complexity or the volume of the evidence requires you to spend more time. And I have found the VAB staff and the VAB clerk to be very cooperative with you in terms of giving you extra time. The only thing we ask is that you request the extra time before you spend it. And if you look, you should be able to evaluate a file and say that you're going to need more than 3 hours or 4 hours, as the case may be. And just let staff know and explain briefly why, and you'll find that they work with you on that. But please let us know before rather than after. Page five. This is some factoids on 2022. I'll leave for you. To look at this. I find a lot of this information interesting. I'll tell you where I get a lot of it. The property appraiser has on her website an annual report. They do this every year, and it is just chock full of statistics at both a state and county level. How many properties there are, how much they're worth, how the funds from the taxes are divided among the municipality, the school board, and the other taxing bodies. And then a lot of other information. It's very interesting statistical stuff, and you may want to look at it. I've pulled a lot of my figures from that. As of last year, 2022, the just value of all property, real estate and personal property in Duval County, increased 21% over the 2021 value. So last year was $148.6 billion versus $122.8 billion in 2021. We're up again for 2023. I don't have that exact number here, but I do know that we have now almost 386,000 parcels of property and real estate in Duval County, each of which has been assessed, and the petitions continue to come in. The deadline for filing petitions was the Tuesday following Labor Day, whatever that was, the 5th or the 8th, or I forget, but it was the day after Labor Day. That was the 25th day following the mailing of the trim by the property appraiser. However, we already have in excess of 200 late filed petitions, which we will evaluate. And the law says that if a petitioner files late and they demonstrate good cause, which is defined in the rules in the Florida Administrative Code for filing late, and if their late filing won't unduly interfere with the board's work in the taxation process, then we allow them to file late. So I'm the board's designee. I evaluate all the late files and make recommendations to the board on whether they should be filed or accepted or not. But the reason Heather and Jonathan didn't stick around is they're still trying to get files logged in. They are, I think, going to be north of 4,000 petitions this year. In 2021, VAB received 2,988 petitions. In 2022, that number increased to 3,383 petitions. That was a 13.25% increase over 2021. This year, I think we're going to be north of 4,000. So we should have a lot more petitions in. As you know, the vast majority of those petitions are probably going to be settled or withdrawn. Last year, out of the 3,383 petitions, we ended up having only 216 special magistrate decision recommend hearings and recommendations and then decisions. So that speaks to the property appraisers negotiating settlements. It also speaks to petitioners who, for various reasons, decide not to pursue petitions that they originally filed. Those are some facts. You'll find many more if you have a look at the special, the rest of this sheet, and also the property appraisers publication. Page 6. Every year, by law, the VAB must publish in a newspaper of general circulation a notice of tax impact. In other words, what did the Value Adjustment Board do this year, and what was the effect on the tax rolls? There's a set form for this, and you're looking at it on page 6. What it does is it undertakes to, it's a little confusing because they require us to itemize this by the number of parcels. Some of the parcels have multiple petitions. For example, someone might seek an exemption, they might challenge the cap, and they might also challenge the just value of the same parcel. So we'll have three petitions for the same parcel, but this requires us to report on a parcel-by-parcel basis. So some of these numbers don't seem to add up, and it's because of the difference between petitions and parcels on that. And Heather has a big spreadsheet. If you want to reconcile that all, she'll be glad to, because she pulled it out on me when I questioned that, and she'll be glad to do it for you, too. But you'll notice, just to use the top line as an example, there were last year in the residential line, we had 111 exemptions, of which one was granted. We had three assessment reductions out of a total of 2,139 requested. This form goes forward to say, okay, what was the reduction in the taxable value of properties? For Duval County, that was a total of $315,537 that reduced the taxes available to the taxpayers in the amount of $5,468. So that's how this form works. I will say I got questioned rather closely by someone from DOR who was very curious why, out of all those petitions filed, we only had three reduced assessments, which he said, you know, that he's not challenging the correctness of the numbers. He just said that's a little, I mean, there was a time when we were reducing 25% on average of petitions that were filed, and other counties routinely reduced 25% to a third of the petitions filed. So this, you know, I don't know why that is. It may speak to the efficiency of our property appraiser's office in getting with the taxpayers and working things out. It may speak to the fact that there were tax reps who undertook at the instruction of their clients to file a bunch of petitions, but their clients then decided not to pursue them. And it could mean a lot of things. It could also mean that our special magistrates aren't looking as they should at the evidence and maybe aren't making looking as hard at the evidence and requiring proof of presumption of correctness as they should. That's speculative. I'm just saying it's one possible explanation, but it's something we need to talk through today. And we'll talk through today what the standards are under 194.301, and then we'll charge you with applying those standards as the quasi-judicial officials that you are. Going to page 7, this is...
Mr. Jeter.
Yes, sir.
Could I say something on that point there that you just made?
Yeah. And I ask everybody who speaks to state their name and then make your remarks.
All right. Austin Hollis, commercial magistrate. My experience over about the last 12 or 13 years is before I found the property appraiser's evidence, if you would, to be lacking. But I've noticed a trend over the last particular 3 years where the quality of the evidence that they're presenting to the magistrate is much superior. And from my own standpoint, I'm seeing less and less where there's a correction needed, particularly in the commercial end. And you know, you mentioned that 25% years ago versus, you know, this past year, there was very little. And honestly, that was what was coming through my mind and coming through the evidence that was presented to me was the work of the property appraiser had improved tremendously. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that years ago, they were having to be corrected. And I think they've adjusted themselves. So that's my opinion on what happened.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
And no doubt the property appraiser has taken notice of the new law and proceeding into that. That's a good clarification. Anybody else at the moment? Okay, terrific. Okay, I'm now looking at page 7 and page 8. This document is mailed to each petitioner along with the notice of hearing for the special magistrate hearing. It's to provide information to the petitioners that is useful, we think, in them going through the process. And I've included in your materials so you'll know they got this in the mail. Anybody who appears before you at a special magistrate hearing received this in the mail. And as you can see, it provides links to websites, frequently asked questions. It reminds them to bring 3 copies of evidence to the special magistrate hearing. I have noticed that sometimes you have a petitioner and a property appraiser who exchange evidence, and so when they show up at the hearing, they think that that's it. They don't have to bring their evidence with them. Well, the evidence exchange is separate and apart from the hearing evidence. And so they need to appear at the hearing and they need to offer for your consideration evidence. They need to provide a copy of what they're offering to the other party, and they of course need to retain one for themselves. And if somebody just says, here's my evidence, and we've already exchanged with the petitioner, so I don't have a copy for him. I don't think you should allow that, because just because you exchange a big pile of evidence doesn't mean you're necessarily going to select that evidence and present it at the hearing. And those are just different. So please, if somebody doesn't have the evidence, and you may have to stop and ask staff to make copies, just to be sure at the hearing that all parties do have a copy of the evidence, and then you can consider it and determine whether it's admissible. Now, the only time the VAB receives evidence prior to the hearing is if a petitioner decides they want to conduct their hearing by telephone, and VAB offers telephonic or in-person hearings now. The special magistrate always has to be in the hearing room, and unless the special magistrate objects, a telephonic hearing can be held, and a special magistrate might object if they feel the particular nature of this hearing requires, for some reason, the parties to be present. That's in the discretion of the special magistrate, but typically we will offer telephonic hearings. In that situation, the petitioner is expected, and the property appraiser are expected, to provide us their evidence ahead of time. Most of the time, evidence gets loaded on the Axia software and is held by the staff, but not released to the special magistrate until the hearing itself begins. The second instance in which the evidence is not presented at the hearing is, as you know, on the petition there's a box the petitioner can check that says, I will not attend the hearing, but I wish you to consider the evidence in my absence. In that event, they must present their evidence to the VAB and their copy to the property appraiser. The property appraiser then attends the hearing. The petitioner doesn't, but the hearing goes forward and the evidence is considered. This handout informational sheet also explains the evidence exchange process, and it explains the difference between the exchange of evidence, which is voluntary and which is initiated by the petitioner at their discretion, and the provisions of the statute, which allows the property appraiser, in connection with a filed petition, to make a specific request of the petitioner for evidence. If the property appraiser, in connection with a filed petition, makes a specific request for evidence, then the petitioner, if they have it, must provide it. If a petitioner willfully denies the property appraiser that evidence, then they are not allowed to offer that evidence. The VAB is not allowed to accept or consider it. And so there's the difference. There's no penalty if the petitioner does not initiate the evidence exchange. There can be a penalty if the property appraiser asks for evidence and the petitioner doesn't present it. It would be up to the property appraiser to object or not. And if the property appraiser doesn't object to evidence, then you don't have to ask if there was an exchange or if this is properly presented. The property appraiser will object if they feel they have a basis for that.
May I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
My name's John McGowan. So you made a comment that I don't think we'll actually be doing this, but you did make a comment that the special magistrates could object to the telephonic hearing versus making them come in person. But if we're not seeing the evidence until the hearing begins, What determination process would you like to see for that? If somebody would maybe more complicated than the attorney, special magistrates, if they needed that, what process do you think they should go through to make that determination?
I made that remark because it's in the rules. It says that a special magistrate must agree to a telephonic hearing. And those rules predate COVID, which more or less made telephonic hearings the order of the day at the time, and now we're having a mixture, although there's a lot of telephonic hearings. I am really unaware of a situation where a special magistrate has objected to it. We have speaker phones, and we have the technology with the evidence being uploaded to Axia to do this. And so I don't really have any precedent to cite to you on, okay, when might you object to it? And I really can't be very helpful. Maybe it's like pornography. You'll know it when you see it, you know? And I would say this, if you find yourself in a situation where you think that the hearing is suffering because the parties and the witnesses are not in your presence, I think you could propose to reschedule the hearing at a time when everybody could come if everybody consents, that makes it easy. If they don't consent, but you feel strongly about it, you can see staff or call me or something, and we'll state on the record your reasons for feeling that we shouldn't have a telephonic hearing, and we may, you have the power to continue or reschedule the hearing. And so I'm sorry I don't have any like precedent or black letter rule to give you on that. There's also a provision in here, this is just sort of an FYI, that notifies the taxpayers of a statutory provision in Chapter 194, which says that despite the fact that you are pursuing a VAB appeal, you still must pay your taxes on time. And if you do not pay, if you dispute your taxes, then there's a provision where you can pay, I think it's 75% of the assessed value plus the the stormwater runoff and the solid waste pickup charges, which are the non-valuation ones. You have to pay those, and if you do that, then that continues your right to the hearing. But if you do not pay your taxes or a fraction that you admit is owing or else this formula amount by April 1st, which before April 1st, the last day, taxes become delinquent on April 1st. So if you haven't paid it by March 31, VAB is required by law to dismiss any pending petitions of people who haven't paid their taxes. Now, what staff does is send this notice out and tell everybody that from the very get-go. It's also on the DOR's website. They're very precise about that. And then what happens is, as we get into March, VAB staff looks at all their pending petitions, and then they send that list to the tax collector and request the tax collector to notify staff which of those petitions still have unpaid taxes. And then we write a letter to those petitioners telling them that if you don't pay your taxes by April 1, and if your petition hasn't been resolved by that time, then your petition will be dismissed. And in the past, we've only had one or two petitions a year that get dismissed, and those are typically people who don't care. I mean, they aren't going to pursue their petition anyway, and they don't want to pay their taxes yet. Those who do care, we give them plenty of notice, and they will, and they have been paying. So this is sent to each petitioner when we send them the notice of hearing. So you can look through and you may assume that they at least were exposed to this information prior to your hearing. The next pages are the procedure script that we ask you to follow. That's shown on pages 9, 10, and 11. And you can look in the training module 4, which has information on how you should open a hearing. What I've done, I've tried to assemble all of the required components of getting the hearing opened and created this script. We ask that you follow this script fairly closely. I don't want you to feel like you have to sit there and like a robot and read something, but these items need to be followed, and you need to explain who you are, what you're doing there, and I ask that you not be cavalier about waiving that. And there's a couple of reasons for that. A lot of people, if you say, oh, y'all want to waive this, they're influenced by that and think that maybe they're going to be deemed troublemakers if they ask you to go through it and give your explanation. Secondly, from my selfish standpoint, at some point I may find myself having to play the transcript, play the recording of this hearing, and explain to the board or explain to the DOR or even explain to a court what procedures were followed and whether everybody understood what was going on. And if I just say, oh, well, yeah, you know, John Q. Public here waived it. We know him. He's experienced. He knew what was going on. That doesn't have the force and effect of your actually having gone through this. So I ask, you know, just for the record, if you will go through the script, explain who you are, what you're doing, what you're going to do. And it's also particularly important, if you'll notice those first few lines of the script where you indicate what the VAB petition number is, what the parcel number is, what the property address is, what the date of the hearing and the time you begin the hearing is. If someone makes a public records request of VAB staff, they need to be able to find it with some efficiency. And if you give them a recording of your six-hour day and each hearing is not begun with these remarks, then they're going to have far more difficulty isolating a particular hearing so that they can either produce the transcript for an appeal or respond to a public records request. And then you also need to make sure everybody understands the time constraints. You will have looked at the petition and you'll see how much time was asked for. Compare that with how much time the property, as the VAB staff has allotted for the hearing, and just make sure that everybody is in agreement that enough time has been allotted for the hearing. If there's 30 minutes allotted for the hearing, and someone says, "Well, I asked for 2 hours, and you know, why didn't I get 2 hours?" Then you know, it's up to you to determine whether that request seems reasonable. The clerk is required by law to take those kinds of requests into account, and they frequently do. If there's a complex or involved or hearing, more time will be allotted. If normally 30 minutes is allotted, 15 minutes for each side. But that shoe doesn't fit everybody. And if the clerk hasn't allotted enough and the petitioner feels they need more time, you may need to, if you agree, to reschedule the hearing to a time when they are able to have that much time to present their evidence. Or you can go ask staff, say, look, you've allotted a half hour. I think we're going to need an hour here. Do I have time to let this hearing run for an hour? And if they have other special magistrates who can pick up the slack, or there's nobody else behind you, the staff will say, sure, yeah, go ahead and extend it to an hour. But manage your time. Compare what the clerk has allotted with what the petitioner has requested and then what the available time is. I mean, that's up to you, but the overriding principle, I mean, we want to manage time and we want to be efficient time-wise, but due process requires that we allocate enough time so that the parties can reasonably and fairly put on their evidence. And that's just one of the things you need to decide, and that's one of the things that this script will evoke, is this kind of conversation. You should ask if any party wants the everyone, the witnesses and the parties to be sworn, then you should swear everyone in. If they waive that, that's fine too. If they want it, it's their right. The property appraiser in a value hearing goes first, and the first thing that you should ask them to do is to state for the record the trim determination. And staff is going to give you, for each hearing, a DR-485V form, which you should fill in, if they haven't already filled it in, with the petitioner's name, the VAB number, and the parcel number. And then when you receive from the property appraiser the trim, just assessed value, exemptions, classified values, and taxable value, insert that in the appropriate blanks in the left-hand column of the DR-485B, the trim value. Then ask the property appraiser, or they will typically volunteer, if they've made some adjustment in their values from the time of the trim, between the time of trim and the hearing. If so, if they haven't made an adjustment, then insert in the middle column the same values as are in the trim column to the left. Insert something. Either, if they've made no changes, the left and middle column will match up. If they've made changes, insert those changes. Then as you leave, when you turn in your log for the day, you also will provide the BAB staff with those completed, just those two columns completed in the DR-485V. They then insert that data into Axia, and then Axia has that, and when you receive your file and you begin working on it, you will not be able to further change those two columns in the DR-485B. The only thing you're going to be able to add is your value after VAB hearing numbers. And so that's to enable staff and Axia to record the trim and before hearing value and to have it of record. And so if there's some issue, if there's a mistake, or either sometimes the property appraiser will give the wrong number by mistake, or you may write the number wrong by mistake, that can be corrected through Heather, but you won't be able to correct it. So please enter that information and turn it in at the end of the day. So I do ask you to follow the script and to maintain an appropriate decorum. Don't be flippant about it, but be yourself. Everybody has their own style, but be sure this information is presented and questions, if any, are asked and answered. Page 13, you can see, is a copy of Florida Statute Section 194.301, Subsection 1, and Section 193.011. Those are the two backbone statutes with which valuation special managers work. They're just going to be included in your materials just for your reference. Your recommendations, your conduct of the hearing, everything should track these statutes. You need to be mindful of what they say, what it requires the property appraiser to do, what it requires the petitioner to do, and make sure that everybody has done what they're supposed to, and your recommendation needs to reflect that everybody did what they were supposed to do. Page 14 is a worksheet that's just sort of for your convenience. It is to enable you to take notes with reference at the top to the 8.193.011 factors. As you know, the statute requires the property appraiser to prove to you, in order to establish a presumption of correctness, they must prove to you by a preponderance of the evidence that they properly considered all 8.193.011 factors. And this provides you a blank to take a note as to what evidence you received and what your notes are in regard to that evidence as to their consideration of those factors. And then the last blank addresses the appropriate appraisal methodology. The statute requires, it says the petitioner has the right to know what appraisal methodology was used to arrive at their valuation. And you need to determine that. You need to know on what methodology the property appraiser relied, and you need to include that as a part of your written recommendation and the reasons why that is the appropriate appraisal methodology. This is just a little worksheet for you to, if you find it useful. Page 15, you will find that there are times when you need to continue a hearing, either to because the time ran out or because somebody needs to get evidence and everybody agrees it's appropriate to continue the hearing to a different date to enable completion. You could, I guess, just let everybody go and then leave Heather to track everybody down and try and organize a time and try and put the continuation hearing together. That's a very unwieldy solution. It puts a big burden on the staff, and we ask that you avoid it if possible. So what happens if you determine that a continuance or even a rescheduling is appropriate, please notify staff. And what they will do is they will remind you of when the next day you're scheduled to be there, and then you can fill this out, and if the next day you're scheduled to be there is satisfactory to the two parties, then they can, if you fill this thing out and everybody signs it, everybody gets a copy, and that officially reschedules or continues the hearing, and staff doesn't have to do anything but put it in the file and wait for that day. So this is a form you should use, and we ask that you just don't just let everybody go if you're continuing. See if you can establish a firm date and time. If that's not possible, staff's willing to step up and coordinate it, you know, after the fact. You may have somebody who says, well, you know, I don't know. I have hearings in other counties. I can't really tell you whether I'm available on that day, although hopefully that won't be the case. But, you know, we're not going to deny somebody a continuance because they don't know if they're going to be available on a certain day. But this is a very good work saver. Page 16 is the what now form. We're going to be asked lots of questions, and so might you, about, okay, we've had this hearing, now what should be our expectation? This what now form explains the process. It explains how much time you have, 14 days, to generate your recommended decision. Then it comes to me, I review it, then it goes to staff who sends it out, and all of this is explained. And a stack of these forms will be in the materials at your desk, and you can hand this to each person as they leave your hearing. If you can't find those forms, ask staff. They will give them to you. But this saves petitioners a lot of worry about, well, gosh, when, where, how, what. And also it saves staff having to respond to many, many calls on that. Page 17 is the DR 493 that the Property Appraiser's Office has filed for 2023. The Florida Department of Revenue requires the property appraiser to complete this form and indicate in all these various categories what costs of sale deduction they make in each category. They are entitled to make up to a 15% cost of sale deduction without having to justify it. If they have a higher number, then the DOR would require the property appraiser to justify that number. They can do a lower number, they can do varying numbers. Back in Jim Overton's early days as property appraiser, they had a variety of numbers for different categories. That was different than most other property appraisers in the state at the time, who just did across the board 15% deductions. And at some point, our property appraiser's office went to that system too. So this DR 493 indicates that the property appraiser's cost of sale deduction, this is what they use in CAMA, this is what they use as a matter of protocol and procedure in their cost of sale consideration. And it's something on which you can rely for purposes of real property. As Mr. Rudin brought to my attention, the attention earlier, the tangible personal property is a different animal, and that's just something for the TPP special magistrates to consider and hear evidence on if it becomes an issue. But as far as your real property, there is authority that you may just accept this 15%. Now, you should have this DR 493 with you at the hearing, and if there's any issue about costs of sale, I think you need to bring up the DR 493 and ask why whoever is seeking a higher than 15% costs of sale or a lower one to provide you very precise evidence to that effect. Which you can then evaluate later and decide. But I say that your default numbers is most often, almost universally, going to be 15% on cost of sale, and the DR 493 is your basis for that. Speaking of costs of sale, last year the Department of Revenue came out with a very lengthy method of deducting costs of sale and the income capitalization approach. The property appraiser accepted the DOR's revised method, and I have just included it here. You saw it last year, and you looked at it last year, but just because it's still in effect and I have included it, it's, gosh, I think it goes to page 44. I think it's pages, it's pages 18 to 43. It's the same DOR memo that was sent out last year on computing cost of sale in connection with the income capitalization approach. Page 44, there are scenarios where if the petitioner does not appear at the hearing, I promised I would. Why don't we take 10 minutes and we'll come back. I'll wrap this up very quickly. We'll move on to some other things, and I'll take questions and hear some of your issues. So I'll see you. We'll reconvene at 10:10. They're interchangeable. I mean, you know, they'll just put a validated in. So I would just set it on the end of the table there, Jonathan.
Well, you have to put
stand.
I'm alive. Hello.
Or the three of y'all could have one every time.
We want a TPP to have agreement.
Well, I may agree to let y'all disagree.
Oh, we all agree. That's what we're all right. Well, I would suggest maybe after the meeting we have
feeling good.
Mini sit down. You and
I have to go somewhere. If we get done before noon, I could do that, but I have to go somewhere.
Yep. Haven't you noticed? Like one example, one question, as an example. The cost of sale applied to TV.
Well, we get crap.
Yes.
Okay. The cost of sale, what about federal income tax?
Who do cap rate? Who do rent?
When you sell TV, that's the cost of the sale.
Thank you, sir. I think Joe Vane had you run into Joe.
Yeah, pretty much is.
Okay, he's got on a yellow shirt. He was sitting right there. He said he has
information. It's okay, I'll wait. I got to give this one to the building.
I don't think that's a cost of saving.
I was going to say, I don't
know if it is.
It's not something.
We've never had anybody challenge this.
Yeah, you have to be wrong. Build property sales, and it's not taken in.
Who is causing
those? So it's not considered for that. So it's not considered.
I don't know.
Criterion A purposes the cost. Okay. It would be the immediate cost.
Terrible.
The only other irreverent thought I have, which is nothing unusual for me, is I think number 8 should be gone. That's an aside, by the way. What about, for example, I had one TPP case last year, maybe. Who had 3,000 pages of evidence.
I'm trying to remember how I
would need to call
and
our staff for two days to go through that.
And I have a responsibility to look at all that
this
stuff.
Believe me, they are not going to deny you that.
No, I understand that. One of the predicaments we have is we don't know what the hearing is going to be about until we walk in the door.
Evidence and all that.
Where if we knew it was
better than that, right? So then I include that in.
$1 million.
You get a phone call?
Oh,
hey. He says.
Situation with $1 billion.
It'd be like all the big beef.
The economy. What they give you.
So that's an example.
It's an evidential.
All this stuff I'm carrying, this is going to take me days.
Well, I'll bet that, yeah.
Or
you and I
can send him an email.
She told us. at what we know, and it's
every hour. Sometimes I'll give you an hour.
Do you guys get the solicitation letters from Tallahassee? Is it to be a special manager over there?
Yeah. We know we need more time or something like that.
Oh, there.
Locations and everything.
Dude, I would wait till after the year.
Why do you do that?
Yeah.
In theory, you can go to any county in the state.
In terms of your
doing the hearing.
What's his name?
I'm not worried about.
Oh, I thought that's what
analysis.
I know doing the hearing was going to be bad.
Okay, you have an hour for this hearing, and here
I don't know anybody who's went over.
Okay. Oh my God, you cannot handle that.
Well,
such
you
a
should.
Hearing.
I think you need to look at their petition.
Then, if there was a break, they didn't want you to charge them.
Which county?
That's on them.
Oh, Leon, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like you go there and you show up.
You know, and because
maybe you'd have an hour of hearings.
Petitioner fills in
the issue in the afternoon.
How much time they need. Takes that. They asked for an hour.
How many meals a day can you guys eat?
They want more, but you know, just.
Why are you retired?
Because I'm still holding it.
It's over the board.
I figured then I'd have to stay.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
The wife does not want me at home.
Let her say it.
Cool. Yeah. Right. Joe, when you get there, all you have to do is put some cane slides on my wife. Closed her business.
This is the only thing I'm doing.
Well, I'm trying to cut it back. Something will come along, but I just can't.
I've done three of you.
Yeah, they can do it from anywhere. So it doesn't tie them down in one location. So a lot of them are still able to travel.
There's the path. I would say, based on what I've seen,
I'm one of the attorneys, so we don't do much. I just tell them, like, 90% of this does not apply to us. Because we don't need to do that at all. We're only doing the exemptions.
Okay.
So, the exemptions under statute, it's really like, did you meet the Chamber's deadline? And that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, I'm in it every moment.
This is very complicated. For us, like, you know, with the tangible and the.
Oh, okay. It's like, why did somebody reach out to you?
No. I'm just, yeah.
Bought a mask.
Well, I think
yeah,
that.
Doing residential.
I can't believe it. It's always
interesting. It's always getting into something where you're back and forth.
It's okay.
No, that's not.
Finding a different attorney.
Bill,
trying to find a question.
I think I had. Three hearings last year.
Four as far as the valuation.
I only had to write two opinions. I think I was scheduled for five.
Two. I know it then because we've got litigation over 20 minutes. Seven problems.
It'll be
in excess of, I guess what I'm saying, this report.
I don't really know. Heather fills this out and gets it.
So,
never gave him the courtesy.
But, your office works with her on
taking on these big.
Well, I'm just saying we had just position. One Amazon got reduced 11.
On top of that,
so we filed litigation.
Yeah, that was
had. We filed litigation.
You probably
remember the old church.
Roger's
27.
Right.
Harvard's trying to say these numbers.
So okay. Yeah.
It was them.
They didn't show.
I had a farm. I don't know.
Yeah, they have three properties. Mainly, they're not a church anymore.
Oh, wow.
And they bifurcated the trying to still. The pastor died. The worker. But
all the way back.
Right, really well.
Headed west, and you cross Maine, right there it says Enterprise. Yes.
Cool. Thank you.
I just knew
the numbers were low.
Yeah.
There's just for the attorney special matter.
Okay, if we can reconvene.
Yeah, well, I just had orientation
in
Nassau.
The one.
I'm looking at page 44, and this is the form of recommended decision that we use. The petitioner is what we call a no-show if they don't appear at the hearing. And what it does is just says that they had no pending request for reschedule or continuance, and they had not asked that the hearing take place without them, and that they didn't appear, and we waited 30 minutes for them. And the reason for this is this preserves their right, if they choose to do so, to file a suit in circuit court. And it's the rule requires us to specify that, so we do. So now, you may be asked to prepare one of these, or staff may prepare it for you on these no-shows. But I just wanted you to know this is what that recommended decision should look like. You are also, if you remand a petition to the property appraiser, and the property appraiser prepares a written remand review based on your instructions. A copy of the property appraiser's written remand review is simultaneously provided to the property appraiser and to the petitioner. That starts a 25-day clock. If the petitioner, during that 25-day period, does not express displeasure with the property appraiser's written remand review and request a hearing or otherwise accept it. If the property, let's just say the petitioner does nothing, 25 days ticks off the clock and the petitioner does not respond, then they lose their right to further hearing. They have 25 days during which, if they are displeased with the property appraiser's written remand review, they can request a continuation hearing. You will come back. You will hear further evidence at that continuation hearing. This doesn't apply to the attorney special magistrates, by the way, because you don't do remands other than you might make a decision that someone's entitled to a classification. Let's say somebody sought an agricultural classification and property appraiser disagreed and you upheld the petitioner. You remanded, but you remanded to a valuation special magistrate. By rule, you're not supposed to remand any petitions which involve request for exemption or affordability, you must rule. Either the parties carried their burden of proof or they didn't, and you must rule. But in valuation situations where the special magistrate has remanded and the property appraiser had presented a written remand review, the petitioner has 25 days to request a continuation hearing. If they don't, then we prepare this recommended decision, which will ordinarily would accept whatever the outcome of the property appraiser's written remand review suggested. So that if the property appraiser came back with their written remand review and said, we're not going to reduce it any further, and here's why, we follow the instructions, and here's why. Or if they reduce it some, but not as much as the petitioner wanted, whatever the written remand review said is typically the final result, and this written remand review decision is what's sent out. So if you're asked to do that, this is the form you should use. And then the cover sheet for the written remand review is page 46. On the question of remands, there's nothing in the statutes or in the Department of Revenue rules that place a time constraint on how long the property appraiser has to generate their written remand review. Excuse me. In other words, special magistrate remands something to the property appraiser. There's no time limit by which the property appraiser must prepare and return their written remand review. At last year's VAB meeting, the last VAB meeting, the 2022 VAB agreed with the property appraiser, and you will find the minutes of that meeting on page 47 and 48, and essentially the property appraiser and the VAB have agreed that aspirationally the property appraiser is going to undertake to prepare those written remand reviews within 15 days from the time that you remand. So just for purposes, just so you'll know, and in case it gets asked at the hearing, well, how long? It's not required. I mean, the property appraiser may find an instance where that's not practical, and they may notify staff that that's the case. But the agreement is that aspirationally, the property appraiser is going to do that within a 15-day period. So those are our orientation forms. I hope you find those useful, and we'll refer to them during the year. This might be a time to take a little break from me talking, and I would like for everybody who's here, the special magistrates in particular, if you're here as an observer and you don't care to do so, that's fine. But I was just going to ask everybody to identify themselves and just tell us how long you've been a special magistrate and what your what your particular role as a special magistrate is, whether you're a valuation attorney or TPP. Jonathan McGowan was a special magistrate last year, and I will be, I believe, this year.
There it is. My name is John McGowan. I'm an attorney special magistrate. I was one last year, and we're working on making sure I'm one this year.
I'm Pam Andrea. I'm tangible personal property, and I've been with the county 13 years.
That's good.
I'm Alex Rudin of Southeast Appraisal. I'm a TPP special magistrate. I've been doing this a long time, and yesterday I decided to sell my firm, by the way, which is kind of fun. And I'm involved in, for 38 years, I've been running a multidisciplined appraisal company, which is real estate, business valuation, and tangible personal property. It's been fun.
I'm Mel Ward. I stay serve as a general, and I'm a special magistrate for Duval County since 2002, and I hear commercial and residential.
Audie Hollis, about 13 years now, and listen to commercial. commercial hearings.
My name is Hank Mullen, and I'm a residential magistrate, and this is my ninth year.
Judge Carter, I think this is my 23rd year as a special magistrate. So I hear residential, commercial, and a little TPP occasionally.
My name is Laura Winter. I'm the Customer Service Division Chief with the Property Appraiser's Office.
My name is Joseph Haynes Davis, and I'm an attorney special magistrate, and I've been doing this type of work since 2008. I'm a little bit tired, so I can't count how many years that is to this year. But, you know, you great mathematicians can do the work for me, but I'm always proud to have the opportunity, and this is my second year with Duval. And last but not least, I am available to take any Jaguar tickets that have not been claimed. Thank you. I live in Orange County.
Good morning, David Boley, residential group manager for the Property Appraisers Office.
Larry C., I'm also a residential group manager. Property Appraiser's Office.
Harry Gethelman with the Commercial Division, Property Appraiser.
Keith Hall for the Commercial Division, Property Appraiser.
Jim Ogburn, the Residential Division, Property Appraiser's Office.
Good morning, Sage Sullivan, Tangible Parcel Property Appraiser's Office.
Good morning, Keith Hicks, Chief Appraiser, Property Appraiser's Office.
Tiffany Pinkstaff, Office of General Counsel. I'm the attorney for the Property Appraiser.
Jonathan Smith, Attorney Special Magistrate, been doing this for 3 years.
Allie Irvin, Residential, about 11 years.
Luke Laurier, I'm a General Certified Appraiser, and so I hear as a Real Estate Special Magistrate, residential and commercial hearings. And I believe, the Lord Bowen and the Crook don't rise, this will be my 15th year.
I'm David Burbridge, residential, been doing it for about 12 plus years.
My name is Joseph Vane. I'm a state certified general appraiser. Just here as an observer.
Welcome. Thank you. I was trying to keep up, but we've got well over 100 years of collective special magistrate experience, and this is a very veteran and conscientious and focused group, and I'm proud to work with the special magistrates. I've got a sort of a random list that I want to go through of just things that occurred to me during the year that we need to think about and focus on, and so I will go through this. It's not necessarily in any particular order, but I will try to do that. Again, if people have questions, let me know. And at the end of this, when I've run through this, I would like to open the floor. And if anybody has anything that I haven't talked about and you think needs to get on the table, I'll be glad to hear that. And whether you're a special magistrate or an observer or any attendee. I've mentioned this once before, but again, as quasi-judicial officers, the Florida Attorney General has determined that this body, BAB, and special magistrates as quasi-judicial officers for VAP are subject to government in the sunshine. The Attorney General has on its website, DOR has on its website, and I believe VAP has on its website, the Government in the Sunshine Manual. But essentially, you are not to discuss pending matters other than on the record, either among yourselves or with the parties,
Everything must be on the record. If someone surprises you, you know, with a phone call or confronts you, or you have unavoidably had some contact off the record, you should let me know, and I will be sure that we let everybody know of this contact, and we'll put the fact that you had this contact on the record and give the other party the opportunity to decide whether they want to make an objection based on that. But everything that we do is in the sunshine. If you have any questions about what that means, I'm happy to try and respond to you. On the question of in the sunshine, when you send me emails or you receive any or send any emails that pertain to this process or a pending hearing, I like to copy VAB staff with everything. So, you know, please do. They have a master record, and every time, if you'll, we frequently will get, I'll get a petitioner who writes me, and I try to remind them that these, that because there's a pending petition, that anytime they write me or write staff, they need to copy the property appraiser, and I will then send the property appraiser a copy or make sure that they do. We just want to make sure that everybody gets copies. It's a good practice to always copy VAB staff at COJ.net with everything. Basically, on a basic level, it's your responsibility to be sure that there is an audio recording made of every hearing that you hold. You need to check and make sure that the recorder is working and that it is on. I don't think you should turn it off. Once you turn it on, if somebody says, let's go off the record, I don't think you should go off the record. I mean, just let it run. If you do determine that something really genuinely needs to be off record, I think you should be sure everybody consents, and I think you should be sure you get back on the record and make sure that the recorder is working when you do. I think the best practice would just be to let that run. And be careful about turning the recorder off simultaneous with your adjournment, because what happens is people linger after these hearings sometimes, picking up their stuff, and there's still conversation, and somebody may try to make a remark to you that pertains to the hearing. I mean, you can't control them if they're picking up their books and they say, oh yeah, and another thing. And I would like that to be recorded, because we have situations where people claim that after the hearing somebody came back and supplemented their information. And if we've turned the recorder off, we don't really have the information to either prove or disprove that assertion. The record is very important. Keep it on, please. Again, I say this every year, we sort of become, all of us sort of get to know one another and we see the same people. It's difficult to remain detached, but I think it's important that you do, as a quasi-judicial officer, you know, have a detachment about you. Don't mingle with the property appraiser, or if you have a friend who comes in who's a petitioner, it's best not to mingle with them and appear too friendly, because others may misinterpret that. And if it's your friend, you just explain, you know, I'll talk to you later, but you know, I can't. got my judge hat on, so I can't talk to you. You know, whatever, however you want to say that. But you know, we got not only to avoid doing improper things, we have to avoid the appearance that we're doing anything improper. Okay, if during the hearing or at any time associated with the hearing, the parties settle or agree, stop the hearing. For example, you have a petitioner who comes in and says, I filed this petition because I don't understand what this is. And the property appraiser explains it. And they say, oh, well, in that case, I don't object. You do not write a recommended decision. You do not continue the hearing. You stop the hearing. You should first say, I am going to stop this hearing and put on the record why you are. Say, the petitioner has accepted the property appraiser's value. Is that correct? Or vice versa, the property appraiser has changed his value to her value to a value that the petitioner finds acceptable. If they reach an accord and agree, you should stop the hearing. Now, I qualify that a little bit. You have some situation, if you stop the hearing, then that may prevent an appeal from being filed to circuit court if one of the parties gets home and says, well, or the people for whom they work says, well, you shouldn't have reached that. I want to go to circuit court. So you will run into instances where, for example, a tax rep may say, you know, I didn't bring any evidence. I really just kind of wanted to understand where the property appraiser was coming from, but I am not authorized to settle this, and I don't. And so in that case, you just write a rather succinct recommended decision, which says that the hearing was convened. The property appraiser, you would require the property appraiser to put on their prima facie evidence, establish a presumption of correctness, and then you say the petitioner did not present evidence but did not wish to settle or withdraw their petition. And the reason you do that is that form of recommended decision preserves for the petitioner the right to appeal the matter to circuit court if they wish. And so that if you're wondering why somebody might say, well, you know, I don't have a problem with the property appraiser, but I'm not willing to withdraw or settle, that's typically why. They want to preserve for their employer the right to go to circuit court because they aren't authorized to lose that right. If you have a lot of similar cases, let's say a McDonald's franchise owner has 16 McDonald's and they all come before you, and you are writing up a recommended decision because this was a combined hearing that will apply to all 16 of these, feel free to run a template of that by me before you prepare all 16 of these write-ups, and I'll be glad to look that over. You can email it to me with copy to the BAP staff so they have a record of that, but I'll look at it and we can make suggestions and then hopefully arrive at a format which you can then spread out among the 16 decisions and not get all 16 of them sent back to you. You don't have to do that, but I and some of the special magistrates have found it useful if you want to. You would just send it to me in Word format, and then I will, you can I'll go back and forth, all of this being copied to VAB staff, and only after we reach that preliminary understanding of format, then you can upload it to AXIA on all the 16. please keep in mind that all your worksheets, notes, any materials that you create as part of your process are public record and need to be turned in with your recommended decisions. They all of them, your little doodles during the meeting, if they are also interlineated with notes or thoughts that you took, that's all part of the public record and needs to be turned in with your materials. Now, in a second, I was going to spend some time on Module 6, but before I do that, I'd like to break and maybe hear from you, and maybe y'all can compare notes yourselves or whatever, about AXIA and how AXIA works for you, and are you experiencing issues or problems with AXIA, and you'd like to get some feedback from the other special magistrates about how they address those. Is there anybody who wants to address any AXIA issues? Hi, this is Value Adjustment Board.
We were trying to, the middle guy trying to figure out where he's supposed to be. All right.
A day will come. No comment. If everybody's kind of, actually has been around us for a while, so maybe y'all all got this down, but I just wanted to have an opportunity while we are all together. Does anybody have any? Yes, Jonathan.
I just noticed, like,
excuse me.
And I don't, this is more just about AXIA itself. I don't know if anyone else. I guess, problem I see with AXIA is that, Jonathan Smith, Attorney Special Magistrate, but, like, when I send something and you review it and you send it back to me, like, I don't always go in and check every day on AXIA. And so often what happens is either you or the staff have to send me an email saying, Jonathan, check AXIA, or you send something back you need to fix. If there was any way for an email be generated through the program just to me saying, you've got something in the queue you need to fix, that would probably speed things along. But that's minor.
That was brought up last year, actually, and I get it. These come to me, and I either approve them or I type changes in and send them back. At that point, I lose it. It's very funny the way AXIA compartmentalizes things. Once I review your recommended decision, make comments, and then reject if that's the case, and it just goes off my screen, and I cannot retrieve my comments unless I get them from Heather. I do not customarily email each individual special magistrate to say that I have sent one of these back. Is that a problem for others? I'll try to remember to do that. I'll try, and if you'll try to remember to check AXIA. But I turn these around promptly. I have 7 days to do it, but Heather's a harsh taskmaster. She usually wants them the next day. So if you don't hear back in fairly short order, then it's a safe assumption that it got passed on. So if what I would say is if you send in a batch of them or send in some, just maybe check for a couple of days, and if it's come back, you will see it. But I'll also try to remember to notify you. Anybody else have anything they want to talk about on AXIA, questions, concerns? That's great. Module 6, valuations. I wanted just to kind of run through this. What I've given you is the red line copy indicating changes from last year. So just because it doesn't necessarily show when you're doing it on the, online on the computer, unless you go to the red line, it doesn't show them. So I thought you might find this to be helpful. And I guess first I'm just going to open the floor to anyone. Does anybody have issues or questions that they'd like to talk about in connection with this process, the evaluation process? Is everything, or is everybody comfortable with the content of the VAB training? And the reason I'm doing this is the DOR is very clear that this training session is not for me to teach you the law. The DOR wants and expects you to follow the DOR training, and that is what we do. Now, as the VAB attorney, I do have the authority and will give legal advice on issues that you feel have questions about after you go through this, or issues that are raised at hearings. That training can't possibly contemplate all the issues that you're going to receive. So that doesn't mean I won't give advice or answer questions on specific cases down the road, but I think the DOR expects us to start with this training and stick with it. I would comment that this Module 6, as well as the rest of the VAB training, spends a great deal of time emphasizing the statute that was amended, the massive amendments that took place in 2009. Prior to 2009, originally the property appraiser had not only a presumption of correctness, but back in days of yore, the only way you could win a case with the property appraiser is if you prove that there was no reasonable basis for the property appraiser's assessment. In other words, there was no reasonable hypothesis on which the property appraiser's assessment could be based. That changed, and at that point, the property appraiser, I guess, presumption was reduced, and the property appraiser was still given a presumption of correctness, and in most cases, the petitioner had to show by clear and convincing evidence that the property appraiser's presumption should be rebutted. Well, in 2009, that changed again, and it greatly lowered the standards for petitioners and changed the approach that the property appraiser was required to take. 194.301 states that the property appraiser, in order to establish a presumption of correctness, must prove to either you or a court, if they're in a court, that they have to prove by preponderance of evidence that they have properly considered all eight criteria in section 193.011, and that they've applied an appropriate appraisal methodology. The statute states that the petitioner is entitled to know what appraisal methodology was employed in arriving at his, her, or its assessment. If the property appraiser establishes a presumption of correctness, then the petitioner can still win if the petitioner shows by a preponderance of evidence that the assessment does not represent just value. Moving from that statute to the rules state and the VAB training states that if the property appraiser does not establish a presumption of correctness because the petitioner shows or the evidence from all parties shows that either the property appraiser failed to properly consider one of the eight criteria in 193.011, or the property appraiser applied an inappropriate appraisal methodology, then the property appraiser loses the presumption of correctness, and the special magistrate is then supposed to consult the record and determine if there's competent, substantial evidence in the record from which the special magistrate can establish the value of the property. If there is competent, substantial evidence in the record from which the special magistrate can establish the value of the property, Section 194.301 says that the special magistrate shall establish a revised assessment, or shall establish the assessment, not necessarily revised, but establish the assessment. And it used to be may, now it says shall. If, however, the property appraiser does not establish a presumption of correctness, and on examination of the record, the special magistrate finds that there is not competent and substantial evidence from which the special magistrate can establish the assessment, then the special magistrate must remand the petition to the property appraiser with specific instructions as to what the property appraiser must do, and the property appraiser is bound by law to follow those instructions. Per the agreement I just told you about, the property appraiser here in Jacksonville will do so within 15 days, and they prepare a response to those to the remand. It's called a written remand review. That will then be presented to the petitioner, copy to you, and the property appraiser will of course have it. And the petitioner then has 25 days to either ask for a continuation hearing or not. But that new statute, beginning in 2009, this was a sea change in how the appraisal process worked for property tax assessments. I think generally there's been resistance, and the DOR continues to work to reduce that resistance, because it's such a change, the special magistrates, property appraisers, the petitioners, they don't get it, and even after 14 years, they're still resisting. But every year, what I urge you to do, and the reason I've given you the copy of Section 194.301, is I urge you to look at that statute and require the parties to track or follow their obligations according to the statute. Now, that brings us to, okay, there's eight criteria for Section 193.011. How specific should you require the property appraiser to be to establish a presumption of correctness with reference to these 193.011 guidelines? And I'll just read you. The property appraiser must comply with each of the 193.011 factors consistent with all other just valuation standards. The property appraiser must avoid cursory consideration of 193.011 factors, correctly apply the factors needed for a credible and lawful just evaluation. I'm reading from page 124. I'm sorry, I'm on module 6, line 43. On page 125, line line 22 and 23, the training says, conclusory statements made by an appraiser reporting an appraisal process are not sufficient and not credible. Page 126, line 30, the elements of standard care, level of diligence for just value reporting must include explanations and reasons addressing each of the valuation approaches and each of the applicable legal criteria regarding what was actually done and how and why in developing just value. So I submit to you that at every one of these hearings, the property appraiser must open the evidence by providing you proof that they properly considered each of the eight criteria and that they applied an appropriate appraisal methodology. And as a special magistrate, you are entitled to and you should question them if they appear to omit or gloss over some of that. And I think an example might be that it might be apparent to everybody that the comparable sales approach is the appropriate way to value a particular piece of property. The property appraiser may come into the hearing, say, what they do is they just say, they'll basically say, in preparing our valuation or assessment, the property appraiser properly considered all factors in 193.011. We applied an appropriate appraisal methodology, and here are six comparable sales at or about January of the tax year, we believe that these support our value. Thank you very much. I think everybody just sort of instinctively thinks that that's okay, but I think the DOR is emphatic. That's what I've given you this. Look at it for yourself and decide if you agree with me that's just not how it should work, that the property appraiser is supposed to say, look, the legislature says I'm supposed to consider the factor one, the highest price a buyer would pay, factor two, highest and best use, and so on and so on. And they have to have considered all of these factors. The thing that I see frequently is in a subdivision, for example, the only approach that has been used, maybe even a better example would be in a high-rise condo at the beach, for example. And the only approach that has been used is the comparable sales approach. And no consideration whatever of the income approach. And the response to that is, well, look, nobody buys these things based on the income approach or on the rental approach. They're buying them mostly, they're owner-occupied, or even if they do rent them, they're buying them based on what they could sell the property for. It may or may not be true, I don't know. But that could be, that certainly is a conclusory statement. And I think that if somebody's going to say, well, all the houses in this subdivision are owner-occupied, or all the unit owners in this condominium own the property themselves, that without some kind of factual backup is a conclusory statement, and one you should treat as a conclusory statement. For example, I have found just a whole handful of articles here, which I'll be glad to share with anybody, that are in the Times Union and News for Jacks and other public, the Financial News and Daily Record, basically talking about how Jacksonville has become an investor town. Investors are setting the market in many of these subdivisions. I saw a Channel 4 interview an Action News interview with Jerry Holland, where he said as many as 25% of the purchases of properties in certain subdivisions were investor-driven. Now, I don't know. I'm not an appraiser. Those of you who are appraisers. The property appraiser certainly has qualified appraisers. Maybe the fact that an investor is buying versus John Q. Public buying is the same thing, same standards approved. But I'm you know, instinctively, I don't know that that's the case. I think the property appraiser's got to show that. I think they've got to determine whether these investors, they've got to provide you information on, you know, did they consider the income approach to this thing? To just say, oh, well, these investors don't care about the rent. They're just holding it for appreciation. That's a conclusionary or conclusory statement, and I don't think it justifies them ignoring the income approach. So I ask you, in your judgment and discretion, to explore each one of these factors to the extent that you think is appropriate. I'm not going to tell you on any given category, you know, what you should do. I will tell you that the legislature has told you that in order for these, for the property appraiser to obtain a presumption of correctness, they have to show by a preponderance of evidence that they have properly considered all these factors. And when you write up your recommended decision, if I'm not able to determine that you evaluated whether or not they had properly considered all the facts, I'm probably going to send it back to you. I think just I can tell you that in the training, for example, it says that if the property appraiser just says we complied with all the factors, or they have a handout that they give you that says here's how CAMA works, or here's what we do, that in and of itself is not sufficient to establish a presumption of correctness. And so what I'm asking you to do is to read the statute and in your expertise as an appraiser, determine what standard the property appraiser needs to apply. I'll be interested in feedback right now and your thoughts, and the property appraiser may have some. This is what the legislature has told us to do. It may not be how appraisers operate in the real world. We may have everybody, you know, you may say, look, everybody knows that you don't apply the cost approach in the case of a 70-year-old home in a single-family subdivision. I mean, maybe they do. But I think you need to, the property appraiser needs to not just make some conclusionary statement. They need to provide you or satisfactory evidence that they've properly considered it. Now, a question I've always been interested in is whether, what's the effect if the petitioner agrees with the property appraiser? You know, you have situations where the petitioner says, we didn't consider, you know, you've got a commercial office building. The only thing we consider appropriate is the income approach. And, you know, can the petitioner stipulate that there's no need for the property appraiser to consider comparable sales or consider the cost approach, and that the only appropriate one is the income approach? I mean, maybe so, but it needs to be properly articulated. Don't just let them both put on income approach and there's no other discussion. I think you need to say, look, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, there's 8 factors here. Am I understanding there to be a stipulation that none of the factors except the income factor is pertinent to this? That is the position each of you is taking. Maybe that's sufficient. But, you know, I will tell you this, that these are not like the real world appraisals. We are bound by the legislature to follow a certain guideline, and that guideline is 193.011 and appropriate appraisal methodology. And I'm just not going to go through all the instances in here, but I will tell you there's over and over it says in here that has to be done. So I ask you in approaching the hearings to remember that as special magistrate, if you don't think a particular factor or a particular methodology has been properly explored, it is not only your right, it's your duty to inquire what happened, and you should be satisfied that the approach was appropriate. Okay? Harry?
Do I need a mic?
I'd like to bring you a mic.
Harry Guthman with the County Appraiser's Office. I just want to point to two areas in the module here on page 114, excerpt 1, which it seems like it's consistently when he mentions the acceptable appraisal practice. It also says acceptable appraisal practices, including mass appraisal standards. Okay. It's also a reference from page 124. Midway down, it said, when properly applied in compliance with all requirements of law, both mass appraisal and single property appraisal are professional accepted appraisal practice. I think we've slanted this hugely as far as its methodology to one thing, which is a single appraisal, and that's not how we value the properties in mass. And I want to go back to your original analysis. You're talking about the condominiums. If the magistrates don't do income approaches, don't rely on the sales approach. I mean, I think everybody in the room would agree from a mass appraisal standpoint in a fee world, single approach, that's acceptable appraisal approach. So why would we go on further if we're saying the legislation says we must consider the income or consider all eight criteria, one of them is the income and the cost, but if they're not applicable to that practice, it's certainly within the range. I can certainly tell you from a mass appraisal standpoint, nobody in the state applying income approaches to condominiums. Okay? So my question is, you're saying if they do that, and they don't mention the fact of the income, that you might not approve it. So who at the end of the day is determining if they're adhering to acceptable appraisal practice? Because when you and I go back and talk about appraisal practices, you say you're not an appraiser, yet you're going to review these folks to determine if they're adhering to acceptable appraisal practice. I'm a little confused on that.
Thank you. I certainly don't think there's anything wrong or flawed about the concept of computer-assisted mass appraisal. That's a very acceptable appraisal methodology for the property appraiser to arrive at its original assessment. And I don't quarrel with that. However, the reason we're at a BAB hearing is because the petitioner has challenged the original assessment. And then the legislature has said if a petitioner challenges the original assessment, here's the protocol you must follow in that challenge. And that protocol is that the property appraiser must enter the hearing and establish a presumption of correctness, and to do so, he must show that he considered or she considered all of the section 193.011 factors appropriately, and that they applied an appropriate appraisal methodology. Now, nobody's faulting the property appraiser for using CAMA to arrive at their assessment to begin with, the trend values. But if what the property appraiser did, and I know you're not going to do this, but I'm just going to make an example. If you, what the property appraiser did was walk in and say, well, here's a printout. We ran this through CAMA, and this CAMA is very expensive and very good and renowned, in fact, and nationally used. And here's the value it came at. Thank you very much. I don't think you've established a presumption of correctness, and if there's evidence in the record from which the special magistrate can establish a value, I think that they're required to do so. I will read from page 124, lines 18 to 20 of the VAB training. It is implicit in mass appraisal that even when properly specified and calibrated mass appraisal models are used, some individual value conclusions will not meet standards of reasonableness, consistency, and accuracy. That's just, I mean, you do 386,000 assessments using CAMA, statistically, some of those will be off. We probably won't hear from most of those who you missed by underappraising. If somebody feels like you overappraised them, they're going to file a petition, and that's when VAB is required to follow that statute. And I reiterate that I am not an appraiser, but I'm a lawyer, and I'm charged with trying to advise the VAB and the special magistrates on following the law, the hand the legislature dealt us, and the hand we've been dealt is 194.301 and 193.011. But once I give those instructions, I defer, and I want to defer, and I think I'm expected to defer to the appraisal knowledge in this room. There are many, many nuances of the appraisal process that I don't understand, and which I expect the appraisers will understand and will explain to me. But my job is to make sure that they explain it in a way that provides detailed findings of fact, detailed conclusions of law, and reasons why they either are upholding or overturning the property appraiser. That's what Rule 12D10, Florida Administrative Code, requires. Detailed recommended decisions. And John Q. Public and Jane Q. Public should be able to read most of those. There may be some that are just so esoteric that nobody can understand them, but I mean, hopefully I will, and I can make the board understand them. But some may be difficult, but most of these recommended decisions need to be written in such a way that the petitioner can understand what happened, who it happened to, and why it happened. And
Just to follow up, I get you from here. So to answer the question, are you determining the methodology or is it the special magistrate? That's the question.
And the question, Harry Gutherman, is do I determine the methodology or does the special magistrate? The special magistrate, definitely. However, if I cannot tell from the recommended decision what methodology was used, if the special magistrate has not stated that and the reasons for it, then I send it back and I say, please elaborate. And if you and I also I think it's within my province to ask if we're in a I'll use that high-rise condominium thing. I know that people put these condominiums in the rental pool, and whether that income approach is the appropriate methodology, I don't know. It may not be. I mean, the final analysis in a high-rise condominium may be the comparative sales approach. But the legislature mandates that the income from that property be considered.
what does that mean? That I've got to develop an income approach?
In certain cases, it may mean that.
How? I mean,
can
Harry Guthrieman, just to get on the record, it's the lay of the land as it is now still, that if the property appraiser relies on the market approach, okay, which they do in condominiums, that you've not only considered all eight criteria, you've applied one or more. That case law is still in existence. So I just want to get that on the record.
Well, it's, and I'll respond to you too. Yes, sir. You get back up here. The in the case of the high-rise condominium, it may ultimately develop that the comparable sales approach, the market approach used by the property appraiser, is the correct approach. But the statute does not allow the property appraiser to just accept that bald assertion. The property appraiser must show that he considered the income approach. Now, the question that Keith Hall just asked is, the chief deputy property appraiser just asked, is how do we do that? Well, it's if you look in the training, it says that it's the duty of the property appraiser to collect data, do research, and I know y'all do that. You do it extraordinarily. But I think you need to determine in a given market whether there are rentals, and if so, you know, what influence or impact that has on the value of a piece of property. You may have suppose you have a condominium and the declaration of condominium prohibits rentals. I think basically you present that declaration of condominium at the hearing and say that we did not consider the income approach because this condominium prohibits rentals. I think that's an acceptable reason why you didn't consider it. But if it's somewhere where there's a rental pool, there's an office, they are allowed to put their condos in the pool, or if you're able to tell because properties that aren't homesteaded, are they different ways for you to find out. It's up to the property appraiser to investigate that. I didn't make the law, but there it is. Pete, would you like to?
Okay, so let's stay on the condo. So I've got a condo, and I'm going to buy this condo, and I want to rent it out. Okay, well, you want to buy a condo too, and you're going to live in it. We're going to be competing in that same market, all right? So as the seller, I'm not going to sell it to me for cheaper because I'm going to rent it out. I'm the seller, he doesn't care, he's leaving. Okay, so again, going back to the market approach, that's going to be the best indicator of value. But if you're telling me I have to develop an income approach to show that I consider the income approach, I'm basically developing and spending a lot of time developing an appraisal that's not credible results. It don't have credible results. Okay? And then you say, oh, well, they have a rental pool there. Do you think they're going to give that to us? No, they're not going to give that to us. So the reality of it is we're going to spend all this time looking for properties that sold, may have been renovated afterwards, which is going to impact the GRM, to do this round robin to come back to what's professionally accepted appraisal practice, the market approach. We consider it, but we know what's the best appraisal method. And usually, that new condo owner isn't coming in and going, well, I think you should do the income approach. Typically, they're not, because I'm renting. Because they know they're competing against buyers that are going to occupy or rent. So I don't understand what you mean by consider and then tell me it's a cursory statement. What is a cursory statement?
Conclusionary would be.
Conclusionary,
sorry. And there's a difference. I don't want to blur the distinction between consider the income approach and develop the income approach. And so they are separate. The statute does not require, and I don't require anything, I just interpret, but I mean, I don't think the statute requires you to develop an income approach and say, here it is, I get a cookie, but it has nothing to do with anything. I get that. But the statute requires you to provide a preponderance of evidence to the special magistrate that you properly considered the income approach. Now, if you were to argue that if you are able to show that the market is driven by sales and that nobody cares whether you can rent it or not, then you should be able to persuade the special magistrate to that effect. Or perhaps the petitioner would agree with you, say, I concur that there is no basis for using the income approach on this property, and that the property appraiser has considered that, and that we should focus, because most of your petitioners, I think, want to focus on what are the pertinent issues anyway. But nobody's requiring you to develop it, but I it's just fraught. All through this module 6, it's like 126, line 30, that the property appraiser must include explanations and reasons addressing each of the valuation approaches and each of the applicable legal criteria regarding what was actually done and how and why in developing the just value. I mean, that's not me. That's the Department of Revenue saying that's what the standard is. You have got to show that. Now, how you do it, and if the special magistrates are professionals too, they feel your pain when you talk about developing an income approach for no good reason. But I think just it says in the training, and I think it makes sense that the reason, well, this isn't said, this is what I'm saying, that the reason we're at that hearing is because the petitioner has disagreed with the property appraiser, disagreed with the approach or the value, or disagreed with some component. And so for the property appraiser to be allowed to just come in and say, hey, nothing, the income approach doesn't apply, let's talk about comparable sales. Maybe everybody in their heart believes that, but that isn't what the statute requires. The statute requires that you demonstrate by preponderance of evidence that you correctly and properly considered that. Now, how you go about that, matter of office policy, and it also is a matter of each case. Each case may be different, whether the income approach is important. I mean, like if you have an investor buying 2,000 or 3,000 homes in Duval County, maybe they only have their eyes on how much of a return they will get on resales over 1 year, 5 year, 10 year period. Are they, however, considering how much it's going to cost them to carry these properties for 5 years? And are they rentable? And if so, under what terms and for how much? And do they factor that into their investment decision? I think that's a matter of evidence that needs to be considered. And I think there's got to, I would assume there's some sort of factual basis or some sort of source to which you can go to determine how these decisions are made. And that's between you and the petitioner and the special magistrate at the hearing to determine whether you properly considered the income approach in a situation like that. Once you get past that, then you know you don't have to work up the income approach if you prove and everybody agrees that the income approach is not pertinent here. But you have to consider. You need to consider the highest and best use. You need to consider, you know, all of these other issues because the legislature says so. And I'm telling the special magistrate, the DRR is saying, the legislature wasn't kidding. This is what we have to do. And Keith Hall's been...
Yeah. This is on the same topic, so...
Thank you. This is Keith Hall, one of the group managers for the Property Appraiser's Office, Commercial Division. Bill, you stated earlier in your remarks before most of this discussion ensued that the Florida Statute 194.301 required the property appraiser to establish a presumption. I don't know if that's the clearest statement. Are we required to establish a presumption? Because very often magistrates will still rule in favor of the property appraiser, even though they may state that the property appraiser has not established a presumption. And it relates back to your remarks, well, a conclusionary statement or a cursory review isn't enough to establish a presumption of correctness. Well, the training also refers to, on page 115, line 45, preponderance of the evidence, it's a lower level, proof means greater weight of the evidence or more likely than not. So if we have you've got a condominium and the income data is available in that condominium. Most of the buyers and sellers are buying it for their home and not renting it out as a investment property. I think that may be, as you call, a conclusionary statement, but it's more likely than not to be true, or at least the magistrate can make that determination, more likely or not to be true than to, remand or force the property appraiser to go through an exercise in futility and try to collect data that doesn't exist. And we're talking about a condominium using a market approach that's superior to an income approach, but what about the cost approach? Cost approach, is that not a valid approach in condominiums? And so that, I don't think anyone's using a cost approach to establish values in condominiums, but yet it is one of the three approaches of values to consider. So we're not properly considering the income approach, we're going to take a step further and say, okay, well, what about the cost approach then on those condominiums? But more importantly, are we required to establish a presumption? And then if something's left out that doesn't necessarily meet your standard, can the magistrate say, okay, well, there's enough here that it's more likely that the evidence presented by the property appraiser or the petitioner, it gives me enough to go on and make a decision and not have to carry on the conversation or remand? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I still have a question. I'm not done with you.
Section 194.301 says that the property appraiser is entitled to a presumption of correctness if they prove by preponderance of the evidence that they properly considered the 193.011 factors and applied an appropriate appraisal methodology. The training rules say that, you don't have to establish a presumption of correctness if you don't want to. If you don't, though, then the special magistrate is required to look in the record and see if there is adequate, whether there's competent and substantial evidence from which the special magistrate can arrive at a value. And if there is, they are required to arrive at that assessed value. If there is not, they're required to remand it to you with instruction. So, you don't have to do anything.
But if you don't establish a presumption of correctness, then your assessment is sort of, it has not been supported, it has not been proven, and the special magistrate then can look around into the record to see if there's sufficient evidence from which they can arrive at a value, and they're required to do that.
But Bill, they're getting instructions from you to consider something else, not to say that maybe...
Let me get that on the record.
Yes, thank you.
They have the cumulative record in front of them, right? And then you're saying, well, you think, in your review, that the property appraiser didn't properly consider the income approach, so you remand, or you send it back to the magistrate for review. So is it the magistrate making the decision about what's the proper methodology and where all criteria comply with, or is it basing it based solely on your guidance in that regard?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, the magistrate's making the decision, but I am required and charged with the responsibility of determining whether their recommended decision complies with the law or not. And if I don't think it complies with the law, if I think there's nothing in there about whether the income approach was considered or whether the cost of sale, suppose they haven't said anything about cost of sale, they have not mentioned cost of sale, then I send it back and I say, you have to provide me evidence that these, or conclusions, if there be evidence on which to base those conclusions, that costs of sale were considered. I do that with everything.
Okay. May I ask, just so it's on the record, this will be the last one for me, anyway.
Since the magistrate is the quasi-judicial trier of the facts, I guess, are they required to comply with your recommendations, or are you simply giving them guidance in that regard for their decisions?
Great question.
Excuse me. Nobody's required to do anything, I said. If, however, I reach a disagreement with the special magistrate on whether or not a recommended decision complies with the law, I will so advise the Value Adjustment Board, and that's my job. If the special magistrate just dug in his heels, for example, and said, "This is how I'm going to word it," and then one thing, the rules require that if I give advice to a special magistrate that is other than administrative or procedural, in other words, if I say, look, this is how I think your finding of fact should be, or this is what I think your conclusion of law should be, if I do that, and believe me, it is rare day that I would do that because I let them decide. But if I do, they are supposed to reflect that in their recommended decision.
Which rule is that? And just help me out. You said there's a rule that require them to.
Yeah. The rule says that if they get advice from me that deals with the finding of fact or conclusion of law, they should say, I consulted with board attorney who advised me that the factual basis for this conclusion should be reevaluated. I mean, they're just supposed to. We just want to be transparent.
Well, thanks. I was just looking for that rule. So just for my reference, the rule for that.
He's asking what the rule number is.
Rule number is for that.
What is the number?
Yeah.
I don't know, but it's
follow
sure.
Up. Thank you.
Yeah. No, that's in the rules. It's in the training. And I ask the special magistrates to remind themselves of that. If we have a conversation, if you call me up and you just say, look, what statute is it again that that deals with rescheduling? You know, that's not, you don't have to put that in. But if I tell you that 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 there if that if there was no evidence on a certain one of the criteria, and based on that you change your recommendation, I mean, I think you should. I think you say I consulted with board counsel, and then and based on his advice, this is what I'm saying. Whether and that's fine, and it, I'm required to give advice to the VAB and to the special magistrates. Ultimately, after their recommendation is completed, I advise the board on whether I think it complies with the law. Sometimes a petitioner or the property appraiser will appear and say they don't think a recommendation complies with the law, and then I also I evaluate that and then make recommendations and give advice to the board. That's why I'm here. Mr. Davis.
Just a quick point of reference on the advice, on the issue of the advice of legal counsel, just quick reference, on the advice of legal counsel to the special magistrates when it is affecting the substantive outcome of the recommendation, it has to be entered in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. Now, what that rule is, all I gotta be transparent. It's 12-9, you know, it's the 12-9D. What is it, counsel? Yeah, 12D-90 dot, I'm sorry, 39, right, dot 030. But the whole point is that, six. And it says legal advice from board counsel relating to the facts of a petition or to a specific outcome of a decision, if in writing, shall be included in the record and referenced in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. If not in writing, such advice shall be documented within the findings of facts and conclusions of law. Now, that's what the rule says. I've been doing it so long that I just remembered that because there have been instances where we've had to, and I'm not trying to take up too much time, counsel. I did want to also mention that in another county, it was very important because myself and board counsel were trying to figure out what was right and applicable with the when you have these condos that have been converted, but they got smashed with the hurricanes. So we had issues then because that was a first impression for us. You know, you work it out, you just gotta take your time and just do your study on the statute. I'm sorry, the rule and statute if applicable. And counsel, I thank you for helping me out. That's what happens when you don't have enough sleep last night because you were so excited to come to Duval. But thank you. Thank you so much.
And thank you.
Holding y'all to those spare tickets, too, not to be too flippant. Not to be too flippant in this meeting.
I know you're joking, for the record, we know you're joking. Okay, well, in any event, I hope that we've covered different. Do you have another remark?
That's not a question.
Okay, so first of all, if the condo's rented, okay, then I'm not going to dictate allow the dictation of the occupant of the property to determine what appraisal methodology I'm going to use. I'm just not. Which method, appraisal method, is going to render the most credible results? That's what I'm going to go with. So you got to help me understand what a conclusory statement is. I mean, it does, you've already said I don't have to develop it. I don't have to develop an income approach to have considered the income approach. But what can I say? What do I have to say? You can't, you're not answering that for me. I'm still struggling with what's conclusory and what's not.
Mr. Jeter?
No, I was just going to, with what Mr. Hickson and
Mel Ward, Special Magistrate.
But what Mr. Guffman and Mr. Hicks is saying, and thinking of a proposed situation, I mean, not only outside of Special Magistrate work as a fee appraiser, but when I'm a Special Magistrate and we have a case before us with condos, I mean, the first thing to me I think of is going to the market. And if I'm looking at a condo situation and if the property appraiser says, this is a 100-unit condo, we've looked at, you know, owner occupancy, it's 95%, we consider the cost of, I mean, the income approach, but don't think it's applicable. To me, I've always accepted that as they considered the income approach and they determined in the market that it wasn't applicable. If it's a 100-unit condo project and it's not high-rises on the ocean and it's easily, you know, ascertained that they're 90% non-owner occupied, then that'd be a case to where I would ask a question, you know, did you do the income approach if they didn't address it already? And if so, why not? So I just kind of look at it in most cases just based on the market and whether it's occupied. I mean, I understand when you say one owner is going to leave it as a rental and one owner is going to occupy it. I look to the whole market to see what, and that's not always that cut and clear, I understand that, but are we correct in that if they make a statement as to they consider the income approach and why they did or did not use it, if that makes sense, is that acceptable?
I think the examples you used both contain factual information from which a conclusion might be drawn. For example, 95% owner occupied in your first example, and only 5% non-owner occupied. If that is the property appraiser's basis for saying the income approach was considered but did not seem determinative in this case for that reason. If and then this your second example, you provided a factual basis of 90% non-owner occupied, which led you to believe that further consideration of the income approach would be warranted in that case, or at least you would question whether or not that had been considered, and if not, why not? And again, this is not our making. The legislature has not said, hey, look, do this appraisal the way you would do it if a bank hired you to do a first mortgage loan appraisal. They didn't say that. They said, here are 8 standards that you're required to consider. Now, every property, every petition is different. There may be some where you don't have to spend 5 minutes on the income approach and you'll be able to present, but you need to present data. You don't just come in a conclusionary statement, as I understand it, is one that reaches a conclusion without backing it up first with factual data. And I think what the thrust of the training is that you need to have at least some factual data that creates a preponderance of evidence to suggest that you've correctly, properly considered this factor. And you are not being asked or required to do a complete workup. You're not being asked or required in every instance to do a complete cost approach. But for example, there are apartment complexes, it's interesting that say, a rental apartment complex for which the property appraiser uses the income approach. But if that complex was built and completed in November of 2022, and so on the tax day, January 1st, 2023, was a month old, the cost approach might be warranted for that apartment complex. But if it's one that's 60 years old, it might not be. That's up to you as a professional to present to the special magistrate whether or not that factor has been properly considered. And I think Mr. Ward brought up examples, and the training requires facts that justify conclusions that the special magistrate and the property appraiser reach. And I will close on this. Unless someone feels a compelling need, I'm going to close this part of it.
Okay, so let's go back to that apartment that you said was completed in November of 22 for 23. But we're most likely actually are going to run that apartment complex on the cost approach that first year, because most likely it's not going to be stabilized yet. So the rental income is not going to be what it's potential to be. So, and of course, it's newer, so we get rid of the physical depreciation. So that makes sense. But, I agree with Mel, but at the same time, I don't, because let's go back to the one that's 95% rented condo or complex. Okay, well, in reality, if I have sales in that complex, most likely that was an investor that purchased it, right? And within, he's obviously going to factor in the potential income when he purchases that. So if I have sufficient sales, the market approach is still going to be probably, most likely, the best, or lead to the most rentable results.
And I didn't say it one. I mean, I'm just talking about income.
Hey, Mel, me and
you good. Okay, I'm getting ready to wrap it up. I'm going to just tell you this. I think you and I have a disconnect on what I'm trying to communicate, because I hear you as arguing that the market approach, if selected by the property appraiser in this condominium, is the right approach, and the income approach isn't the right approach. That may be right. You may be absolutely correct. But you've got to prove it. You can't just come into the special magistrate hearing and say any nincompoop should know that the income approach doesn't apply here. Therefore, we're going to just use the market approach. The legislature, the statute, don't allow you to do that. They require you to go through the drill. The drill says that you have to show by a preponderance of evidence that the property appraiser correctly considered these factors. And how you do that and the amount of evidence that will be required to carry your burden will differ from property to property. And, so neither you nor I can really make global statements about what should be done or what's going to be acceptable. But in each case, while the CAMA approach was appropriate to arrive at the original TRIM assessment, the statutory approach must be followed if you hope to prevail, I guess, in the VAB hearing. And then a court hearing thereafter. Those are the rules the legislature gave us. Okay, last one.
Yeah, Tim Longmer with the property appraiser's office. I think you're right, what Keith said. There's really not a disconnect maybe with us and the special magistrates Again, I guess I'd point out that, you know, you want to throw out 193.011, and that's in conjunction with appropriate appraisal practice. They know that. And so therefore, I don't think the way you presented all this proof and everything is so great, because again, they're the appraisers. They're the ones that are the special magistrates. So, for example, you want to keep bringing up single family unit and income. I don't know that the 193.011, see, that applies to everything. So obviously some of these things don't apply to a classified park parcel. Or, I mean, you know, we've got a lot of different uses besides single families. 193 covers every single type of property there could be in existence. So proper consideration of 193.011 is also hand-in-hand with 94.301. It's not separate. I think they understand it. I think our concern is maybe some influence by the BAB attorney to the special magistrates about how they should interpret appraisal
concepts.
So you bring up, and you've got all this training, is there anything in here that talks about income and single family unit? Or is this just an example you've come up with yourself that you feel is appropriate? Just curious, because I've never seen anything. I'd love to see some examples in here in the training on a single family unit and income.
And you won't see that.
Okay.
The training, the statutes, the rules all create a framework that applies, to use your word, to everything. And that means every single hearing. Now, the weight that's going to be placed on the different factors and the weight that is going to be placed on the evidence is the province of the special magistrates. I try always to ask questions. I don't tell anybody, and y'all can correct me here, I'll stand corrected. I don't tell anybody what to rule, ever. But I ask questions. I say, look, you have not mentioned, for example, the income approach anywhere in here. Was it discussed and was it considered? And if they say, well, no, they just put their comparable sales in place. And I say, well, you know, the statute requires that at least be considered. And, you know, was it? And if it wasn't, either you should find they didn't, if you find they did not consider a particular factor, then they must lose or forfeit their right to a presumption of correctness. Or you can remand it and ask them to consider it. And if they say, look, there is sufficient evidence in here that the income approach is not applicable, the petitioner didn't raise it, it was agreed that the only appropriate approach was another approach, then, you know, that's up to the special magistrate how they want to do that. But my job is to interpret the statute and make sure that the recommended decision I make reflects that the special magistrate followed the statute. And if I don't see on the face of the recommendation evidence that he did or she did, then I bring it to their attention. In 35 years, I've never told anybody, hey, this petitioner should lose or this petitioner should win. Never, never. Have I asked questions? Have I said, well, did you consider this, or did the property appraiser raise this point? Yeah, that's what I do. I'll keep doing it. But in any event, Mel, let me go to Bud, and then I'll come back to you, and then we're going to close. And I cheated y'all out of a break. I'm sorry. Bud Delaria, Special Magistrate.
I'd just like to say something pretty simple, and that is I've interacted with Bill for 14 years in this venue, and I also do tax protests in other counties, and I can tell you that what Bill has described here in the last few minutes is totally accurate. He has never, ever imposed any kind of instructions or outcome to me, at least. Now, if he's done that to somebody else, I don't know. But I would just say that what we have to consider as special magistrates, you can throw FIREA out the door, use PAC, all of it, because people in Tallahassee decided they were going to tell us all how to report this. And so we got to follow the law. So this is a substitute for what we might do out on the street as fee appraisers. And so what Bill demands of us is that we follow the law. He's a stickler about it. If he looks at something you've done and there's something there that doesn't look right, he'll certainly ask you about it. I'll guarantee you. But he has never, in my experience, placed a mandate on me to do anything. I'm done.
Mel Ward, Special Magistrate.
Yeah, I just want to reiterate what Bud said and what Mr. Jeter said. This is going into my 23rd year here. I can honestly say, Mr. Jeter reads our reports, and if something's not clear, he knows there's going to be other people reading those reports. And if there's something that doesn't follow the law, or if there's something that looks like, like you mentioned, no mention of the income approach or whatever else, he asks us questions. But in the past 22 years, he's never directed anything. He's always said, you're the appraiser, you deal with the value, but, if he has questions about it following the law, that's the way he's always handled it. He's never, ever, because he's even said, I'm not telling you how to appraise it. But something doesn't make sense, and you need to clarify on this, or you have one sentence addressing this, you need to expound upon that, because that appears to be the crux of the case, or whatever the situation is. But I'll definitely vouch for, him not directing us in any way. And he also reiterates, make sure you put in the report that you counsel with me, and I advised you on the law part of it, so...
Okay, thank you all. I think our time's up. I hope this has been useful. I think it's good to get feedback from the property appraiser, and this is sort of the time we can all share these ideas. I hope that what we've presented today is useful. We've got very veteran special magistrates, and I know y'all know what to do. And we'll go out and do it. If anybody has any questions, anytime, all the time, please feel free to let me know. And thank you all for your attention.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it.
Can I ask you something?
Okay.
All right. Yes.
That counts that would record, so hopefully my humorous remarks to taint
the
big common draft.
Thanks, David. Good seeing you.
I tried to set him up. I got him set up in another area of the office just to get him in.
Yeah.
He's
a good kid. He really works hard.
Yeah. 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 Yeah needs to develop.
That might be,
yeah, just, you know.
I don't know if that would be.
Learn from them, guys. They'll teach you.
Yeah.
They go.
You know, I mean, I'll be glad to share ideas with you anytime. Call me all the time, anytime. I may do the same with you.
Yeah, but I want to.
I agree. There has to be any evidence. I agree. It's a 15% reduction. It's just one. Well, two notices, just one week. So maybe count it like four.
It's what it
is. That's a good
deal. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a
okay.